Coming up today, Facebook's next big VR move, Virgin's Hyperloop gamble, and we try to bring some sense to the oft-sensationalist world of artificial intelligence fear-mongering. You're listening to episode 339 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Tempton, and joining me are Ollie Franklin-Wallace.
Hello.
And Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
We won an award, guys.
We did.
Well,
well, you won an award.
Well,
the team won an award.
We won. And also we didn't win. Yeah, we won silver for best entertainment podcast in the Loveys. We mentioned it a couple of times. It's prestigious. But it is the first place loser.
Also, we came joint silver, so it kind of counts as third.
So complicated, isn't it? So the Economist won.
We are the Bing of podcasts.
Yeah. So well done. Well done to us. And thank you to everyone who voted. We really do appreciate it. So that's nice. We should start with facts. Roland, would you like to go first?
Yes, except that I've forgotten the sheet that I wrote my fact on.
Okay, we'll come back to you.
Okay. Shall I just disappear right now?
Yes, okay. Yes, disappear and go
okay,
and get it.
Right, you carry on with your facts.
We'll keep going seamlessly. There's no need to stop recording.
This is award-winning stuff.
Yeah, it really is. Ollie, what did you learn this week?
Well, my fact is actually pilfered from Wired's retail conference, which took place this week. And it is the interesting fact that every day each of us scrolls the distance, the size of Big Ben in our news feeds. So if you scroll with your thumb, apparently...
I'm back.
Apparently,
good.
You scroll the size of Big Ben in your news feed every day. Isn't that an interesting fact, Roland? Seamlessly done.
Brilliant. Sorry, I don't look as startled as I might do because I just told you that about 5 minutes earlier. But yes, well, Big Ben, eh? I never.
I mean, the amount of finger movement.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it?
And that's each person. So cumulatively across the entire world, that's a lot of scrolling.
That's a lot of scrolling. Too much.
Facebook is everywhere. Roland, what did you learn this week?
Well, so should we play? I wanted to do a little guessing game, which I know you hate, James, but let's do it anyway. Yeah. So, what would you say is the European record for cumulative days in space? So, how many days
total?
Total
for one person.
For one person.
257.
Well, the American astronaut has just spent a year in space. Let's say 400.
It's 350.
Oh, that's, yeah.
So. Yeah, but host held by a retired German astronaut called Thomas Ritter. And this guy, Paolo Nespoli, just came quite close to it with 313. But I think he's just missed out. But it's really interesting because we've got a piece on this in the magazine, which is basically about veteran astronauts. All the astronauts on the International Space Station are in their 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And they're kind of really logging up a lot of time and space, and we don't have a clue what it's doing to their bodies.
Well, we'll find out, I guess, over the next 20 years or so. But is the reason that they're veterans, it's because it takes so much training and so much special knowledge...
Exactly.
...to go up there that you kind of just have a select group.
Exactly. And also, I think because it's something... The operation up there is quite known. So it's not like you're doing something new and, you know, they're just kind of keeping the same people on, I guess.
Hmm.
Which bodes well for the rest of us when consumer spaceflight happens, because, you know, if your dad can go to space, then you'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we're saying is I don't actually have to work out in order to go to space.
You might be a bit too tall to go to space.
Oh, I'm too tall for everything.
Yeah, too tall for space. I learned this week that dolphins can decide to die just by stopping breathing, which might sound like a weird thing, but your ability to breathe is completely subconscious. Like, you don't have to think to breathe. A dolphin has to think to breathe. So if it wants to stop breathing, it just goes, all right, and dies.
I find that absolutely
never distract
incredible.
A dolphin.
Yeah, never distract a dolphin.
Because does that mean that then dolphins, that what's going on in their heads is like, breathe in, breathe out.
They're constantly at yoga.
And then, ooh, exactly. salmon, and then yeah. Breathe in, breathe out.
Because we know that famously they're super smart.
Yeah.
So, I mean... How does that even work?
Mindfulness.
Yeah, so humans, of course, can breathe with the conscious mind is asleep, and our subconscious mechanisms control involuntary systems. But Whales and dolphins must keep part of their brain alert to trigger each breath. So even when they sleep, they only shut down half of their brain. And then they wake up and then they shut down the other half and then they go back to sleep again. So they have one eye open and the other half of the brain shut down and they breathe.
They are the Gandalfs of the sea.
Yeah, there we go. Marine. There'll be some more marine facts later.
Can't wait.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Every time I come on this podcast, I'm just so horrified that we are still doing the quiz.
Yeah, I know. It's the most popular feature of the podcast. I have decided, yes. Our first story this week. Roland, we're all a little sleepy because we had two Wired events this week. We had Wired Retail on Wednesday and Wired Energy on Thursday. So two action-packed days. You were there for neither of them because you were in San Francisco hanging out with virtual reality people.
Yes, so I went on a... So I flew to San Francisco on Monday, did a tour of Facebook all day Tuesday. Or maybe these days are different because I've really lost a lot of days.
I think you went
week.
On Sunday, Roland.
Honestly, it's so strange. I feel so confused.
You're so jet-set, darling.
Just really jet-lagged. And then went to Oculus Connect, which is Facebook, the Oculus, the company that Facebook owns, their big VR conference on Thursday. I think I did miss a day out there, but anyway, it was a really, really interesting trip, and it was great to be there to see the latest kind of VR stuff live, and also to see Mark Zuckerberg speak in person, which I've never done before. And let me tell you, there is just no way that someone that awkward can run for president. No way.
Well, we'll see.
At least it's an improvement on Palmer Luckey because he's not doing kind of alt-right memes from the stage, right?
Yeah, I mean, just his. The watching those jokes land flat in person actually made me cringe.
It would be interesting to see him like living normally, like behind closed doors. Zook, what goes on?
Oh, I'm sure he's perfectly nice and normal and fine.
Yeah,
but it's just you know, it's a skill that certain people have to be able just to tell a relatively kind of light-hearted joke on stage, and he has the exact absence of that skill. It's actually incredible watching him completely fail these
a team
jokes.
Of comic writers working for him. Probably.
On the subject of Facebook awkwardness, there was also that incredibly awkward VR moment this week where he decided to tour a ruined Puerto Rico in VR and then had to issue an apology for that happening. So it's not been a great week for Facebook in terms of reputation and doing slightly awkward things in VR.
And it is, Facebook is an extremely weird place. I found it quite stressful, actually. The motivational posters, it was like they'd just taken over, and they were everywhere, urging you to be better the whole time. I found it really stressful. It was such a relief to go to Instagram, where everything was just really kind of cute and beautiful, but at least it wasn't motivational.
Felt very, very different.
Yes. Because Instagram's got a separate building on the Facebook campus. Yeah. So we cycled over there on bikes and then got chased by some guy because only employees are allowed to use the bikes.
Oh.
And then the Instagram building is very Instagrammy. But as compared to Facebook, it felt more like a normal place, which was quite a relief.
Do you have to put on like Amaro tinted glasses as you walk into the... When you say it's very Instagrammy, I'm just trying to work out what that actually means. Or did you mean it's like everyone's super healthy and wearing yoga pants?
Well, yeah, both. But also, just there are lots of kind of Instagram spaces where you can... So they've got this one room, which is kind of like a Scandinavian... Like the room in the most perfect Scandinavian.
So the design aesthetic is very different.
Yes, exactly.
Whereas the Facebook offices, we did a profile of their Messenger platform a couple of years ago and did some photography. And then it was when they just built this new purpose constructive facility. And it's sort of these vast hangars...
Exactly, and that area I found quite kind of oppressive, actually.
So you were there to kind of get a feel for Facebook, but you were mostly there for virtual reality and for Oculus. And this
exactly.
was the company that Facebook bought for $1 billion.
$2 billion.
They were out there first with VR. Oculus was sort of the thing that kicked it all off.
Most expensive Kickstarter ever.
Yep. Then it all sort of went bad, and now they're trying to make it come good again.
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of technology, it didn't really go bad. It just kind of went
Didn't go
slowly.
Anywhere.
Exactly. Although, definitely, like, I think there was a false perception that they were in the lead to start with, when actually they were just first.
Yeah.
And now most people would say that they're, one of the better ones, but not anything that special. Although, I have to say, the demos that I did there, I was really impressed by what they had, although they won't be releasing it any of the kind of more exciting stuff anytime soon.
Yeah, so this is Oculus Connect. It's a big developer conference. They make lots of big announcements. They roll out Zook to crack some great jokes. And the big product that they announced was a new cord-free headset.
Exactly. So the product launch, there were so many announcements, but the main one, the product launch that might have caught your eye, was Oculus Go, which is a cord-free headset that works on its own without a PC or mobile. So basically, if you've got a VR headset right now, either you have to use a cord to plug it into a PC, those are the kind of really powerful ones, or you slot your mobile phone into the front of it, which is fine. And this is going to be exactly the same as the mobile ones, but you don't need to have that really high-end smartphone to use it.
But you don't need to have a really high-end smartphone to use basic VR headsets anyway. You just sort of slot it in.
Well, it depends, because Daydream and some of the others require the Samsung Gear.
Right.
So you're kind of tied into those platforms,
I
right?
I see.
Exactly. So basically, the Samsung Gear VR works with the Galaxy S6, which is, it's kind of... It's on the more expensive range of smartphones, and you're not really going to change your smartphone just to use VR. Well, I mean, you might, but it's kind of unlikely. And then the Daydream, the Google one, only works with the Pixel, which is their super expensive new phone.
Right.
And Apple, and so for instance, so there isn't a VR headset that works with the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the thing is going to be kind of relatively affordable for this sort of thing, and it's going to be $199, released early next year. Although it won't do anything new, it should just open up the market a little bit more, because people who don't have access to it can go out and buy one of those if they want.
Right. So it seems like a good thing?
So it's a fine thing.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you and I, the Wired office is full of Google Cardboards. We have Daydream. We do actually have an Oculus rig. What would be the killer feature that's going to stop me from kind of using my iPhone with a Google Cardboard and shell out with one of these new Oculus headsets?
Because Google Cardboard is pretty basic and clunky. This is going to be that little bit smoother. But to be honest, unless you really, really, really wanted to try this stuff, I wouldn't bother.
And it doesn't have positional tracking, which is... So you can only move your head.
Exactly. So positional tracking is the thing that really makes this stuff amazing, because then you can move around in the room and it'll follow you. And this doesn't have that. It's just got head tracking, so you can move your head from side to side and back and kind of back and forth. So it doesn't really do the magical thing. But I did try their new Project Santa Cruz headset, which does have positional tracking and it doesn't have a cord.
Right.
And that kind of maps the room around it, so you don't need to kind of plug into anything else, and that is amazing.
But this is
also a couple of years away.
Yeah, it's for developers only for the time being.
Only next year.
Oh wow, so it's very, very far off, and when it arrives it will probably be very, very expensive.
Exactly. And it's just one of those things where it's like Oculus Go, it'll be pretty fine, but when you try the other thing, that's when you think, wow, this technology there, there really is something there. It could be amazing.
Yeah.
It just feels quite distant, really.
Mm-hmm. And then when you... Well, and before we get to that, you said there were a lot of announcements. Should we just rattle through a few of them now?
Yeah, so, there were so many, and mainly kind of minor tweaks to make the services kind of work together, which is interesting to people like me, but probably pretty irrelevant unless you're using quite a lot of VR. But the ones that I found interesting were Dash. So... This is a new operating system that runs inside VR apps, so you can kind of flick between them, that kind of sounds like nothing, but at the moment, that's basically impossible.
Right.
And so if you were trying to use VR to work, you'd have to be going right back to the very beginning, then going all the way into your other app. You couldn't multitask.
Mm-hmm.
And so this allows that, and it also allows you to pull your existing desktop apps into VR, which for most people completely irrelevant, but for certain professions, like if you're a designer, could actually be really useful. And then another one I found interesting was, which is probably going to have a much bigger impact, and I wrote a piece about this for the website, was Facebook 3D posts,
mm-hmm.
which is actually an AR feature. And what this means is that it should be up now, the Facebook newsfeed will accept interactive three-dimensional media files,
yeah,
aka... the moving hot dog, if you want it. So you can build something in VR, put that file into the newsfeed. You can then, from the newsfeed, take it into another VR app or use it on top of kind of existing files in that kind of classic Pokemon Go style.
So all of a sudden, without realizing it, a billion people around the world, or 2 billion people around the world, however many are on Facebook now, suddenly have access to an AR feature.
Exactly. And that,
without even knowing it.
Yeah, and one of the big things that that Zuckerberg announced in his keynote was that they were going to get a billion people into VR.
But he didn't say when.
He didn't say when. And to be honest, I know they're desperate to get to kind of, you know, bring back the positive side of this stuff. But I just think it's crazy to go around saying this stuff, because in 10 years' time, people will still be asking him, ha ha, remember when you said a billion people in VR? Like, when's that going to happen? Mm. But a billion people could, it's really feasible to think that a billion people could use mobile AR apps. I mean, even, you know, in the next like 2 years. So yeah. I thought that this was actually the really impactful thing.
Sure, and I think the thing that's kind of fascinating that Facebook's really working on with Oculus and integrating AR into some of the camera apps is that, you know, Facebook's real big growth area now in the kind of dystopian world is like reality. You know, Facebook, you already see all of your like screen, all of your screen media through Facebook. Now you're going to start seeing reality through Facebook. So. And it always flashes back to Zuckerberg at the F8 conference last year, where he was announcing the camera app, and his killer feature was, if you are having coffee at breakfast, you can add another coffee cup so it makes it look like you're not having breakfast alone, which I think is the most slightly depressing thought ever expressed on stage at a tech conference. But hey, there's AR. It's going to make us all not less lonely, but at least look less alone on
the
Instagram.
Illusion that we're all happy.
Yeah. Yeah, and
that's what it's all about, guys.
Yeah, and I think this kind of thing of that Facebook, or well, that there'll be digital media hanging all around the real world, which we'll be able to look at. I think that feels like a really kind of compelling vision, at least compelling in the sense that I think it will work.
So you've been back for not very much time now, but you've had a little bit of time and not very much sleep to kind of soak it all in. How was it as a big sort of showcase for Facebook's ambitions for VR?
That's a good question. I think, thinking about the event, if I'm honest, it felt like early days for this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was all very slick and really well put on, and there was loads of interesting demos, but it didn't feel, if it hadn't had all that, it would have felt like, you know, kind of another one of those quiet VR events that I go to in some like conference hall in Nell's Court and see all the same people that I do at all the other events.
But this one's ginormous and it's got Zuck.
And yeah, and so I think that I feel like that the timelines for VR are no closer than they were this time last year, really. So yeah, you know, it's slow going.
Well,
slow
Roland, we'll have you back on the podcast in a few more months when there's another big VR announcement and I'll ask you all exactly the same questions and we'll still be where we were 6 months ago and 6 months before that.
I mean, it is really interesting what's going on now. It's just that you always get into this debate about when is VR going to be here.
Okay, I'll stop it. I'll learn.
Yeah. Just like, I think escaping from that debate is what allows you to see what's interesting.
Well, speaking of escaping from the debates about when things are going to happen, this week... there was a pretty surprising announcement, I think, around Hyperloop. Ollie, you spent a long time reporting on the various Hyperloop projects and the interesting people that are involved in it. And now Richard Branson's part of the party.
Yeah, so, I mean, this kind of happened yesterday, so it's fairly recent news for us. But the news broke this week that Richard Branson has invested an undisclosed amount in Hyperloop One, the Los Angeles-based transportation startup. Richard Branson will join the board of the company, which is going to rebrand, so it's now Virgin Hyperloop One. For people who don't know or don't remember, the Hyperloop is an idea that was proposed by Elon Musk back in around, I think, 2012, for a new type of high-speed transport system, which basically uses levitating pods, and they travel at supersonic speeds inside a vacuum tube or a near-vacuum tube. So the idea is it's like a train, except it's in a tube that has no air in it, so you can go super, super fast.
Yeah, like as fast as a plane.
As fast as a plane, yeah, but on the ground.
And from San Francisco to Los Angeles in 30 minutes, from London to Edinburgh in 9 minutes.
Yeah, all of those kind of crazy projections. Hyperloop One, which you may remember, Wired ran a big exhaustive feature, which probably this time last year, which I reported.
If it was exhausting to read, it was exhausting to write.
It was an adventure.
Did you say exhaustive or exhausting?
Both.
Yeah.
So Hyperloop One is one of these companies that was that kind of sprung up after Elon Musk released the white paper. The big issue at the time is that it was mired in this huge, slightly acrimonious lawsuit between two of the co-founders. One of them sued the other for $250 million after someone in the company basically threatened him, or allegedly threatened him with a hangman's noose. There was various other allegations of impropriety. That case was since settled out of court. The co-founder in question, Brogan Van Brogan, launched a different company since then. But there's also been lots of other Hyperloop news since then. So, for example, Elon Musk has launched his boring company to dig tunnels. And he's declared that, you know, he's actually going to be interested in building Hyperloops after all, eventually.
Originally sort of open-sourced it.
Yeah, and basically said he was too busy with Tesla and SpaceX. And
liar.
Now he's got AI research and Neuralink and all these other things. So he's clearly finding more time in his schedule.
Yeah.
Hyperloop One is probably the most advanced of all of the Hyperloop companies that we've seen in terms of a few months ago they demonstrated a full system with a pod, you know, which was basically just like a nicely designed piece of ballast. They actually managed to get it to about 300 kilometers an hour in a vacuum tube, so they're making some progress. They've had a huge amount of investment and partnerships with some fairly serious engineering companies. And Branson, I think, adds a little bit of a little bit of razzmatazz, and hopefully kind of helps them get past some of the branding issues that they were having after their whole kind of lawsuit situation.
So this is a significant moment for Hyperloop. It's been, we were complaining about, well, basically you complain about it every week, that there are news stories saying that Hyperloop is going to be coming to the Czech Republic, Hyperloop is going to be coming to Malaysia, to wherever. Every time that they announce these strategic partnerships to do a little bit of research and maybe publish a paper, the news reports it as if we're going to get plane speed, ground-based transportation in the next couple of years. But it's not. This is decades away.
Well, I mean, it's hard for me to say. Richard Branson said that it was, he told, I think it was CNBC, that he thinks it's a kind of 2 to 4 years away with the new company. I will remind
Branson.
You that I'll remind you that Richard Branson said in 2008 that he was going to be sending passengers into space by 2009. So let's, and that was, you know, a long time ago. So that's still not happening. So let's take that with a pinch of salt. And also, we're kind of living on Elon Musk time. Elon Musk makes these big promises, and to his credit, he's done some of those things.
Yeah,
but never quite happens on schedule. But I mean, Hyperloop as an idea, anytime you read a news report that says, "Oh, we could have a Hyperloop by 2018," close that window and never read it again, because we are thinking, you know, we are years and years away from. There are some really fundamental engineering problems to be solved. That's the fundamental one being, how do you actually get a hyper thing about going 700 miles an hour in a tube, in a vacuum tube, is that the vacuum tube needs to be incredibly straight to be able to fire something the speed of a bullet in a straight line along long distances. That's incredibly difficult to do above land, and if you're doing it underground tunneling, that's going to cost you billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars. So until Elon Musk kind of solves the tunneling cost problem, I think Hyperloop may be some way off for us to see it in any kind of capacity that's going to make a difference in people's lives.
And is there one place in the world, I'm thinking like in the Middle East or something, where people with more money than they know what to do with might invest in this and actually try and make it happen?
Well, it's funny you say that. Well, inevitably. There are some countries in the Middle East, and for example, Dubai has been very interested in Hyperloop technology because, like you said, like there's large expanses of land which don't have much on it. It's fairly easy to dig there, and also the government is supportive of these new technologies. So, but there's also been other interests from China and Russia, and so the potential interest in a public transport system that can go 700 miles an hour and is cheaper than rail. It's huge. Whether it actually can go 700 miles an hour or be cheaper as rail is kind of what will remains to be seen.
But other than the Stardust, what Virgin brings along with it is years of experience of negotiating and working with Bombardier, with Airbus, with some of the biggest and most experienced engineering firms in the world. And now Hyperloop has a seat at that table.
Absolutely. I mean, Hyperloop has already been, that company has already gained sufficient clout, where I mentioned in the story a year ago that they're able to get the seat at the dinner table with Putin and kind of world leaders.
Yeah.
But in terms of the industry clout, like you said, the Virgin partnership probably helps them make inroads because they have those connections through Virgin Trains, through Virgin Atlantic, and through Virgin Galactic. This huge network of engineering connections and talent and clout which he brings to that company. So
yeah,
it is a significant step. I don't want to make light of that. But I also just want to kind of hedge people's expectations as to how soon you're going to be kind of riding the Hyperloop line into central London.
Yeah.
How did the people behind this story feel about how the people behind Hyperloop One, I mean, feel about your story?
I couldn't comment. I know that the people from Hyperloop Transportation Technologies were not as happy as they might have been. But then again, you know, I don't want to go over the whole thing. You have to read it. I'll tweet it. You can go back
we'll,
and read it.
We'll
the
include
story.
A link in the podcast notes for you.
What I would say about that story is that company, Hyperloop Transportation Technologies, was supposed to have been built its Hyperloop by next year. It was meant to have break ground at the time that we went to press. It's still not done so. So I'm not sure that anything that I wrote in that story has been proven incorrect just yet.
It is an absolutely incredible story. Just the characters, the noose, the hangman's noose left on the desk as a threatening gesture.
Yeah, there are a series of things in this that you really, 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 really couldn't make up. And now that we've added Branson...
Oh, yeah.
Well, who knows what will happen next? So it continues to be this weird high-level engineering soap opera, and one that we'll definitely be keeping an eye on.
It's the most interesting story about what are basically trains you've ever seen.
Oh, I don't know. Trains are pretty interesting all the time. A little change of pace now. Earlier this week, Matt Reynolds and I got a chance to sit down with Professor Toby Walsh, a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of New South Wales in Australia. He's just launched a new book, Android Dreams, giving his perspective on the challenges and opportunities of artificial intelligence. I started off by asking him if the fear-mongering hype around AI was justified.
Well, there are some things we should be worried about, but yes, there's a lot of hype you read in the newspapers that maybe feeds the dystopian fears that people have, and the things that the things we should be worried about today, they're much more prosaic in many sense than the things that you read about the Terminator-like scenarios, Skynet, and so on. Things you hear, there are some things like algorithm and bias, and maybe the effect that automation is going to have in employment that we should be thinking about today, and perhaps we should be worrying a little less about Terminator and the end of humankind by the robots.
And that's what your research is really focused on. It's identifying those prosaic things, as you put them, which have a really, really fundamental impact on people's lives. So even though it sounds boring, an algorithm having a bias against people is hugely damaging.
It's hugely damaging. I mean, it was discovered that people are being locked up because of biased algorithms. The Compass program in the United States is used, 20 of the 52 United States is used by judges to help them decide sentencing. It's a machine learning program. It learned how to identify who was likely to reoffend. Now, you could use that for good purposes. You could say, well, okay, that's where we're going to spend our limited probationary services and keep those people on the straight and narrow. That would be a good use, but that's unfortunately not how it's being used. It's being used to decide sentencing.
And so, you know, how do we kind of fix this problem? I mean, is it as easy as that? Is there a, you know, would you suggest a kind of algorithmic justice board or?
Well, I'm not sure that we actually really want to give those sorts of decisions to machines. But to go to the problem of how do we fix the bias? Well, first of all, we have to recognize there is bias there. We now know there is bias. We could try and get out of the bias that already exists in the data. We then have to think about what does it mean to be racially unbiased? This program was racially biased. It was more suggesting that more black people were going to commit crime than would. What would that mean? We actually even really don't have a very good formal definition of what it means to be racially unbiased.
So this is because it's a reflection of a human problem. So the people who are creating these algorithms are putting their own biases into them.
It may be that people are putting biases in it, or maybe a reflection of the data. That let me suggest perhaps that police officers, maybe they're arresting more black people, so therefore black people seem to be turning up in the statistics more often. So we might run the risk that social biases, things that we don't actually want to happen, are going to be baked in by the algorithms learning on data that itself was biased.
So in academic circles, is the debate around AI slightly less geared towards fear-mongering than it is in public discourse?
Yes, certainly. There's much less fear about that. There is a healthy AI safety community that is thinking about these long-term problems, but most of us, as you say, are much more focused on these more prosaic problems of, well, how do we make sure that if there is a bias, how do we know that there's a bias in the algorithm? How would we eliminate that bias?
Is this a new problem?
It's a new problem in the sense that we are giving machines the right to make decisions, and those decisions might have life or death consequences. They might decide who gets locked up, or they might decide what your autonomous car is going to do. So that's the new aspect of it. We're actually giving more and more responsibility to machines, and we're realizing with that responsibility, you know, come certain requirements.
But with technology companies before, they might have said that, so say when Microsoft created Microsoft Word or Excel, it was creating a technology that didn't have a distinct moral leaning. It just helped people make spreadsheets. Whereas now we have those same technology companies creating algorithms that do have impacts on our lives. And we've seen them struggle to navigate how they communicate that and how they engage with academia about that and how they engage with the public about that. So that's a new problem for technology as well.
It is. So there have been some reactions to this, things like the partnership on AI and companies setting up ethics boards to think about these issues. I actually think this will be a golden age for philosophy, because the decisions that were implicit between us humans are going to have to be made explicit enough that we can write formal code that actually encodes those decisions. So it will be, I say, every company is going to have a CPO, a chief philosophical officer, who actually helps them come up with these decisions and works out how their ethics are going to be.
And I wonder, I think it seems to me that what part of this problem is that we think that because a machine has come up with the answer, it's the right answer. And as humans, we may be like, you know, don't rate our own decision making. You know, I wonder, you've spoken before about the idea of kind of stupid AI. I mean, could you give us an idea of how AI isn't always as clever as we might assume it is?
It is that companies like Google have sold us a complete lie that the algorithms are in some sense less biased or unbiased compared to humans. Algorithms can be just as biased as humans. It may be because there was some implicit bias in the algorithm, or it may be that the data it was trained on. There are lots of sources of bias that can creep into a decision that's made by an algorithm. And it worse than humans. Humans, at least you can ask to explain, why did you come up with a decision? Many of these algorithms are things that you can't explain. So in some sense, we may actually be going backwards. I think some of the hard-fought rights for racial, sexual discrimination, age discrimination, we may actually give up because we find that we've given them to algorithms who can't no longer explain what they've done.
This links to one of DeepMind, which is arguably the largest artificial intelligence research company in the world, owned by Google. Their stated mission is to solve intelligence, to develop what they call artificial general intelligence. Well, that's very problematic if what you're saying about the intelligence of that intelligence is true.
Well, first thing you have to not worry about is that there's a long way to we get to artificial general intelligence. If you ask most AI researchers, they'll say it's at least 50, if not 100 years before we get there. So it's not something that's going to happen overnight. But we will have to worry about if we do build machines that become more and more intelligent. At the moment, the machines we build just have very specialized intelligence. They can solve one task. They can play Go very well. They can answer Jeopardy questions, or they can diagnose melanoma or read mammograms better than humans. But it's only one task they can do. So nothing yet that approaches the breadth of ability of the human brain.
But while artificial general intelligence, as you say, might be 50 or 100 years away, a form of artificial intelligence that has a broader scope than single applications maybe isn't so far away.
No, we are giving responsibility to machines that work on single applications that do have, you know, very moral dimensions to them. So we do have to start thinking about the ethical sides of this, and that's why companies like DeepMind are responding by setting up ethics boards to think about these issues, that they really do have to think about them. These are corporations that are having a very big impact upon our lives.
You mentioned before, it's quite intriguing, the idea of a chief philosophy officer to sit alongside a CTO and a CFO. How would that work?
Well, I think some of it's going to have to work by having more legislation. I think we actually need government. Government is actually letting us down here, that these sorts of services are now public goods. And they're responsible for, you know, much of our lives. You can't imagine our life working now without the internet, and elections are being run and informed by the internet. These are public goods, and companies like Facebook do shy away from taking responsibility for the fact that they are now the largest media company, and with that comes responsibility. And I think that, you know, we do have to regulate the tech companies a bit more strongly. Their motive is not necessarily the public's good. Their motive is to improve their share price, to serve the needs of their CEO and the like. That does not 100% align with the needs of society.
And the flip side of that problem is that governments need to regulate, but they don't understand the technology that they need to regulate against, and have shown, in this country at least, an unwillingness to understand that technology.
It's true, yes. One of the challenges in this space is that politicians don't really understand the technology. There is actually an ongoing House of Lords inquiry into artificial intelligence at the moment. I wasn't very impressed by the last inquiry that came out of the joint committees of the science and technology of the House of Commons and the House of Lords.
What's wrong with it? What unimpressed you?
Well, this committee was asked to write a report to say what we need to think and worry about in the future, and its main recommendation was to set up a committee. We asked a committee, and the American recommendation was to set up a committee to monitor progress in AI. There was actually a much better report that came out of the White House, the Office of Science and Technology, the policy office of the White House. Unfortunately, that was under the Obama administration, and that's rather been lost now by Trump, who has actually got rid of most of the staff of the Office of Science and Technology, sadly.
So having a broad view over how governments are responding to this challenge of artificial intelligence across the world, is there a country somewhere that's doing good work in this space from a government level?
Probably Estonia is one of the most innovative countries. I mean, it's inventing itself as a digital government and having digital citizenship. So that's probably the place to look for. But the EU is also reasonably ahead compared to the UK in terms of the Data Protection Act that's coming into force next year, demanding the rights that we need to demand about the protection of our privacy, our data, things that need to happen in this country as well.
Toby, I'm interested to hear about how optimistic do you feel? Because obviously, I agree Estonia is kind of a good example, and what the EU is doing seems hopeful, but it does feel that perhaps that otherwise tech companies kind of had the free rein to do what they want and then kind of deal with the consequences afterwards. I mean, how optimistic do you think the future of algorithmic bias and these kind of bad parts of AI, what does it look like?
I'm reasonably optimistic in the sense that previously, when they were building spreadsheets and word processors, it didn't matter to our lives. Now we're realizing it really does matter. And there's a number of examples of instances that have happened where people are starting to wake up to the idea. And that's the first step to actually putting in the place legislation to actually make sure that we all do benefit from the technology and that the benefits are shared around.
And how can people outside of academia and outside of policymaking help to influence the decisions and the debate that's had around AI and move us away from this hysteria and idea of a Skynet of a Terminator?
Well, the first thing to do, of course, is to inform yourself, to be better informed. And that's actually why, I hate to plug it, but that's why I wrote the book, to try and let people understand better where the risks of the technology and what are the things that you should be demanding for. How should you be protecting your privacy? Should you click that button that Facebook says, can we own all your data? Maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should demand that Facebook doesn't own all the data. It would be a much better world where you owned your own data and you got to choose who got to use that data. Not Facebook, but you.
So is this more of a generational issue, I wonder, the way that people who have grown up with the internet interact with it and have more of a cynicism of it, even though they're using far more of its services, that if the politicians who tend to be of an older generation were able to grasp the technology more on a day-to-day basis, that they might be able to legislate against it in a more applicable way?
Yeah, so I think there's this dangerous sort of fatalism that people have, that they believe the future's fixed and we just have to adapt to it, as opposed to the future's what we demand for today. It's the product of the decisions we make today. And we could demand that we need to own our own personal data. We could just make that demand and say it's not acceptable that companies ask you to click terms of conditions that you are too long for you to ever read, and then ultimately to own data about you. It's you that they own. There's some truth to that meme that, when the product's free, you are the product. And maybe we actually just have to legislate that they're not allowed to make those sorts of, ridiculous claims upon you.
To bring this back to Elon Musk, if I may, there are probably few people in the world that dominate the news cycle around artificial intelligence as much as he does. His statements are problematic, though.
He is. He's very concerned about the existential risk that AI poses and not so concerned about some of the immediate things, which is rather ironic because, the one thing that Elon Musk is certainly going to do is put a lot of taxi drivers and truck drivers out of work. his Tesla cars will put lots of taxi drivers out of work. And that's going to be the most immediate consequence of AI, probably, that's going to impact upon people's lives in a very interesting and potentially damaging way. For most of it, it's going to be great. The price of taxis is going to plummet. Cars are going to be much safer. It's going to improve 95% of our lives. But if you're a taxi driver, it's not probably going to improve your life. And that's something we need to think about, the consequences, and how are we going to make sure that all of us benefit from the technology and not just the owners of the robots.
Is that a way of Silicon Valley mindset almost? And that I get a sense of dismay amongst academics that Silicon Valley is very keen to solve the big problems and skip over all the ones that are actually far more significant in the interim. So Elon Musk talks about all sorts of big problems around AI, but doesn't engage in the simple problem that he might put millions of people out of work in the next decade.
Yes, there are some very dangerous ideas in Silicon Valley, the very dangerous sort of neoliberalism ideas of just, you know, it's enough just to disrupt. I mean, we end up the situation like we have today with a company like Uber, where it's hard to know where to begin to criticize a company like Uber. It's so, everything it does seems to be, and yet the vision that Uber had, the vision, the idea of connecting people with cars to people who need transportation, is something that we could have done with the internet without putting this billion dollar corporation in the middle that behaves so badly and steals all the value from the people who actually own the cars and the people who want to do the transport. And so to the extent that the people who, you know, Uber drivers are having to live in their cars because they're not earning enough money. And we could have rebuilt that technology today, cutting out the middleman that behaves so badly and all the other bad behaviors that are coming out of we're discovering about Uber, which is sad because the vision, the Silicon Valley vision, the internet vision of connecting people, you know, frictionlessly, could have been there, but we've ended up in this very bad local minimum where we've got this terrible corporation where it's hard to know. So one thing your users could do is just delete the Uber app immediately from their phones and start using a service that's behaving morally responsibly.
But as we've all seen, even all the problems that Uber's had, the convenience and the price for some people are too difficult to get past. They're too good.
That is the problem. That's the problem. Our human failing. We're seductively lured in by short-term returns without realizing the long-term price of some of our decisions. And the long-term price of using Uber is that we're sanctioning the sorts of behaviors, the sorts of things that we're discovering that goes on at Uber, which most of us find morally repugnant.
So as a final thought, if you will, what are your hopes for artificial intelligence and for the sort of drive of innovation in this area over the next few years?
I have high hopes in some sense because it's one of the few hands of cards we've got left to play. We have to invest in technology. There's a bunch of really challenging problems to the planet: climate change, the financial crisis, the refugee problem, all these global problems. And the only way that we can hope to solve them and deal with the increasing population on the planet is if we invest in technology. The only reason that we live lives that were better than our grandparents is because we invested in the technology. And so we have to invest in the technology, but not without realizing that we make choices along the way. And those choices are ones where we get to decide whether we end up with a utopia or a dystopia.
Professor Toby Walsh, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And if you want to read more of Toby Walsh, his book Android Dreams is out now, and he also wrote an op-ed for us on some of Elon Musk's AI hype. A quiz. It's time for a quiz.
Oh, joy.
Roland, you're looking slightly tired behind the eyes. This week we published a story about Dara Orbach, a researcher working to understand more about the evolution of marine genitalia. Part of her work involves getting frozen dolphin penises sent to her lab, where she defrosts them, blows them up with a beer keg, and sews them inside dolphin vaginas, all in the name of science and understanding evolution.
And now you're going to pivot to a quiz.
Yes. How much do you know about dolphins?
Clearly not as much as this researcher.
Yeah, definitely not as much as Dara. So, do dolphins sweat? Yes or no?
Yes.
I'm going to guess yes as well.
No, that was stupid.
No. Always hedge. Yeah,
No. Nil. They don't sweat.
It's a 50-50 question.
Yeah. This is going to be the first ever quiz nil-nil draw.
Yeah. Bonus fact, dolphins stay cool by releasing heat through their flippers.
Okay, great for them.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, nil-nil. Question two. In the 1996 remake of Flipper, who plays dolphin-loving teenager Sandy Ricks?
Macaulay Culkin.
I have absolutely no idea.
Say another, like, child prodigy actor.
Say Macaulay Culkin as well.
Kirsten Dunst.
No, it's Elijah Wood.
Great.
Oh, man. Frodo.
Completely gettable. Nil-nil. Question three.
Are these all dolphin-themed?
Yes, it's a dolphin quiz.
This was not established earlier in the episode.
Yep. Okay, question three. What's the largest dolphin?
Okay, is it Flipper?
Well, not in terms of box office. Come on.
Is a narwhal a dolphin?
I mean, you can guess that if you want.
I'm gonna guess either a narwhal or the Miami Dolphins.
Great answer. I'm going to say bottlenose because I've heard of them.
No, it's that most misleading. Nil-nil. It's that most misleading of dolphin, the killer whale.
Oh,
which
yes.
Is, of course, it's a dolphin, also known as an orca. Males grow up to 8 meters long.
This is a classic.
How have I seen all of the David Attenborough series and I don't know that?
Yeah, it's a dolphin, guys.
This is a real kind of midweek game.
Yeah.
They're tired. Nothing's really going on. Still nil-nil. Let's just settle for the draw. I'll take the point at the
It's Wigan against Bolton. How long do killer whales or orcas live? The closest person will get a point.
Oh, break the deadlock.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to go for 80 years.
80.
80? That's a lot of years.
Mm.
I'm going to go...
Or is it?
I'm going to go 30 years.
Oh, no. Roland storms into the lead.
Yes.
It's
get in.
70 years or more, but around 70. Bottlenose dolphins, who we mentioned earlier, live to around 40 years. So killer whales live a very long time in dolphin years.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Okay.
The Japanese women of dolphins.
If you say so. So that's 1-0 to Roland.
Very long
final list. Final question. Final question.
My chance to break even.
Yeah. And there's no tiebreaker, so you get to share the spoils, like us in the Lovey Awards for Best Entertainment Podcast. Question five. Young dolphins and whales have to move constantly or they will drown. Why?
Young dolphins or whales have to move constantly or they will drown. Is it because they're really heavy?
Is it?
Interesting.
Presumably it's because they have... intake gills, and therefore you need to have water flowing through the gills in order for them to breathe.
What?
No, you were close, but
it's
wrong.
Because they're not buoyant or something.
Yeah, it's that.
They're not buoyant.
That's what I was trying to get across with heavy.
They're heavy. No, they're actually too light. They're not born with enough body fat to float easily, so they're too dense. Too dense.
Yes.
So what you're saying is that dolphins swim like Mario in the early 2D versions, or if you don't
just
kind of tap the swimming button, it just kind of sinks down.
Yeah. So they rest. So baby dolphins and whales rest, eat, and sleep while their mother swims, towing them along inside her slipstream. And it's called echelon swimming. At these times, the mother will also sleep on the move. And in fact, she will not stop swimming for the first several weeks of a newborn's life. If she does for any length of time, the calf will begin to sink.
Ollie, you must be relating so hard here.
Yeah, I can. Having a 12-week-old daughter, I can confirm that this is exactly what parenthood is
and
like.
That's where the phrase sink or swim comes from.
Oh, really?
Whoa,
no, probably.
It's probably from sharks, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're the famous... Why would it be from any fish? I'm so tired. It would be obviously from the humans that have to sink or swim.
Yeah, I guess. So there we go. We've learned a lot about dolphins. We've learned a lot about Hyperloop. We've learned a lot about VR.
Ourselves.
And we've learned a lot about ourselves. That is it for this episode of the award-winning Wired UK podcast. We'll see you again.
Runner-up.
Award. No. We won. We get a trophy. I'm going to bring it in.
All right.
It'll look great. We'll see you again next week. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.